Well, thank you very much, Bob. And I also want to thank Dr. Bruce Friedman most sincerely for inviting me to speak. This is a conference that he's organized very successfully over many years, and this is my first opportunity to be here. So I'm not sure how we get to the next slideshow. If that will do it, no, that doesn't. So I'll just keep talking. Problem is that with all these information systems we have, sometimes the most basic needs are not quite met. And I know that once we get to where I am, we'll be able to rattle on. And I have a lot to talk about this afternoon, and I really, again, very much appreciate the opportunity to discuss this with you. Thank you very much. So what I'm going to talk about this afternoon is, I think, quite related to a lot that we heard this morning, may be able to deal with some of the issues that were brought up in the middleware session, and I hope that the information that I'll be telling you about will be useful and helpful to you. I'm going to go through, firstly, the history of laboratory testing. As one gets older, so it gets more interesting to look at where we've been, but nevertheless, it is important to know where we've been if we want to find out where we're going to go in the future. So we look at the history of lab testing. It'll give us a context. We look at hematology processes and decisions as we have them. We will be looking at some data. I'll tell you about a very innovative and unique, it seems, project, which was the International Hematology Consensus Group, which worked together to come up with something which is very useful to hematology labs. We'll talk about the implementation of those consensus rules that that consensus group developed, and then we'll spend a little bit of time on how we implement these consensus rules with either middleware or an LIS. Well, let's look at the early days. In the early days, we had manual reagent preparation. Everything was manual. Manual procedures, reagent and sample pipetting, reagent mixing. We prepared the calibrants and controls ourselves, and we did everything manually. Colorimetry was manual. Adjustments were made manually. The readings were made manually. We used manual calculations. They were handwritten. We used log tables. We used slide rules. And here we are in 1967, in my lab in 1967. This young man is reading the results of a test that he has manually prepared, manually did the reagents. He's reading it in a colorimeter. He will be adjusting that analog wheel to get an answer, and he'll then be calculating the result. So how did he calculate the result? Does anyone remember the slide rule? And the slide rule had a slider, and on each side was a stationary part. And so you moved the slider along. And depending on how good your eyes were and your manual dexterity and also the resolution of the distinctions, the gradations on the slide rule, so you would be able to calculate the result. And a lot of your accuracy depended on how well you could use that slide rule. Then, again, in the early days, we did manual reviews for validity. There were individual decisions. The individual performance of the particular technologist doing the work and doing the validation was important. There was a weariness factor, and there was a lot of inter-individual inconsistency. In the last four decades, we've seen analytical automation, and we've looked at the impact of analytical automation on the performance of our labs. There's been a progressive improvement. We have enhanced sophistication. It's now ubiquitous in clinical labs. In addition, in more recent years, we've had peri-analytical automation. Let me explain peri-analytical automation. It's a word that we've coined. It's a new word. It's a neologism. And for those who have some experience with psychiatry, neologisms is an indication of some kind of craziness. So maybe it's a little crazy. But it is to combine the words pre-analytical and post-analytical as peri-analytical, in other words, everything around the analysis. So it's similar to perinatal or perioperative, it's everything around it. And this is more recent, as we know, and it mainly concerns robotic systems. And then we have information processing, which has certainly grown apace over the last four decades. It has mainly been post-analytical with reporting, and recently we've had validity assessment, which I place in the context of peri-analytical information processing, and it requires expert systems. So let's look at some performance data. This is our own experience at Mount Sinai with analytical automation. And as you can see, in 1965, the director of the chemistry lab, Dr. Laszlo Sarkozy, actually has data going back to 1965. So we were able to track through 1980 and then through 1997, with the orange being tests per employee per year and the green specimens per employee per year, the increase in productivity. And you can see that as automation, analytical automation, came into the lab, there was a significant improvement in productivity. And then it kind of plateaued off, so it was close to a plateau. So then in 1998, we actually went live with an automated core laboratory, and this is a photo of the automated core laboratory, and it complies with what Robert Michel had called the total lab automation. In our lab, which is, I believe, kind of unique, specimens are truly untouched by human hand from the time they're put onto the track at the beginning until they end up in the refrigerator at the end, having been aliquoted, having been processed, having been analyzed, and even after an add-on, it's pulled out of the refrigerator automatically and goes back for add-on automation. So this is our version of analytical automation. What impact has that had on us? Now we see, with the analytical automation which was introduced in January of 1998, how we've had an enormous improvement in productivity in our chemistry lab. And this productivity is for both specimens and tests. So that's the impact on chemistry. Now, we also, at the same time, put in the peri-analytical automation in hematology. And this shows our hematology line with the analyzers in front, and as you see, in our lab, people are sitting at the back at terminals and also using microscopes. So we have a complete flow-through system from the time the specimen is placed on the track at the beginning until it gets through the end. Smears are made automatically. Smears are reviewed by humans. And this is where we will be talking more detail in just a few minutes. So that's the hematology lab. I don't have data going back to 1965. But I do have the data from 1998, which is actually from 1997, which is the year before we introduced peri-analytical automation. And you can see the tremendous increase in hematology productivity as a result of introducing peri-analytical automation on top of analytical automation. Looking at the data in a little more detail, here are the hematology tests in orange, and as you see, they've gone up from 1998 through 2003, which is the last year for which I'm using the data, and you see that those have gone up. But notice, at the same time, pari passu with the tests going up, we've actually reduced our lab staff. So this is how the productivity really has an impact on the lab. As tests have gone up, we've reduced staff. And what has this had? What effect has this had on the cost per test? In yellow, we have the total cost per test. You see a progressive reduction. And in orange, we see the salary cost per test, which is the labor cost, and that has gone down significantly. But notice a point of interest, that the lines are almost parallel. So the improvement in cost per test has been essentially improvement in labor cost per test. Well, that's all very well, and we've certainly achieved some great data and some great improvements. Now, for us, as well as for all other labs, what is the next big opportunity? The next big opportunity seems to be automated decision rules, where we would be able to apply auto verification to the results we produce. We'd be able to do automated reflex testing based on the results produced, and these decisions could be made automatically with expert systems. This is applicable to labs with an LIS, clearly. It's applicable to some labs with automated analyzers, but not a good LIS because it can't be done in the LIS. It's certainly the next big thing for labs who are using peri-analytical automation. And clearly, it'll have quality, service, and cost benefits. So let's look at again at some of our data in hematology at Mount Sinai. in the hematology lab, which is not only the automated section, but also the lab which does the esoteric tests in hematology, a wide range of coagulation testing, red cell enzymes, hemoglobin fractionation, et cetera, et cetera. We have 10.8 FTEs for three shifts on a five-day week. Total worked hours of 403 hours per week. You can read faster than I can speak, so I'm not going to go through it line by line. Of those 403 hours, you can see that supervision takes about 36 hours. I'm including here supervisors as well as lab technologists. Operations, total hours, 148, which is 37% of the total. And look down at the bottom. Total review, 37% of the total. An amount of time which is equivalent to the total time spent on operations is reviewing results and looking at smears, smear review as well. So a large portion of the time in our hematology laboratory is spent on review. And this was prior to order verification. So we then introduced a couple of things. We introduced order verification. And we decided we'd have the criterion. Our rule would be we would order verify if all analyzer results are normal. And only 6.25% were order verified. Well, given that we said everything had to be normal, we're a tertiary care institution with very sick patients. Most patients don't have normal results. Not surprising, but that was the only benefit we really achieved. We already had smear review for analyzer flags and also other criteria, and 27% required smear review. And the white cell differential was done in 8.4% of the total number of samples coming through that hematology lab. So what is the validation or verification process? Because this is really the key to what we'll be discussing. To validate the test result, we have to review the QC results for the run, review the analyzer performance, perform a delta check. Delta check's been spoken about before today, but the two aspects of a delta check which are important are the new result may be similar to previously known abnormal results on that patient, therefore we don't have to go through manual smear review or other verification procedures because nothing has changed significantly. Or the specimen may have been drawn from the wrong patient, or there may be sample integrity problems, so it's been drawn from the same vein as an intravenous drip is flowing. So to do the validation, we'll compare related test results if available, and there's a multitude of variables. Once we've done this, what are our actions? We validate the result and report if it meets criteria, repeat the analysis, dilute and rerun the sample, perform a reflex test. Now, for most labs such as chemistry, endocrinology, immunology, etc., the actions involve the same analyzer. We'll repeat, we'll dilute and repeat, and reflex testing is minimal. One of the few is for HIV. Even if an immunoassay test on HIV is abnormal, if it's a positive, then you have to do Western blot. But for most others, the reflex testing is minimal. But hematology is more complex. What makes hematology special? In the hematology lab, there's a much greater complexity of work that has to be done. So what do we do after the automated CBC and differential results have been produced? We could verify and report. We could repeat with or without dilution on the same or other analyzer, and here's where the new and special things come in. We examine a smear, a manual intervention, a manual reflex test, if you like. We may do a visual differential count. We may do a manual platelet count. We may do other follow-up tests. So there is a much bigger and better combination of analyzers and humans working together to produce the final patient results. So this is a close-up of the portion of the lab at the back of the analyzers, and here you see a group of people, and what they are doing is reviewing results on the terminals and looking at smears. So this has to be done. What are the principles that we use for review? We want to reduce the number of samples requiring review to the greatest possible extent. We know that analyzers are fast with a low cost per test. Humans are smart, but we are slow. And we have a high labor cost. And good ones are becoming harder to find. And we know the tremendous dearth and shortage and the growing shortage of laboratory technologists and laboratory professionals is going to be an even greater problem as the years proceed. Analyzer false positives will mainly cause more work because we have more smears to review or more manual or other follow-up tests to do. False negatives can harm the patient, so therefore we want to minimize both false positives and false negatives, but a false negative has far more serious clinical import. So what are the criteria for review? We have to determine lab by lab what's safe, what's most effective. How do we know? How do we know what's safe and effective in these one lab's experience enough? And clearly, one lab's experience is not enough. And for this and what follows, we have to thank Dr. Berend Haun, who unfortunately died about 2 years ago now, and he was the founder of the ISLH. The ISLH is the International Society for Laboratory Hematology. It's a society which is growing. It is becoming the preeminent society for laboratory hematology and is doing a lot of good work. And Berend was the inspiration for the International Consensus Group. He thought and he decided and he proposed and he persuaded that we should set up a consensus group of people in the hematology laboratory community who'd had a lot of experience with decision rules and who were implementing and using decision rules, and that we should meet together and see whether we could reach some kind of consensus which would be useful not only to the group of people meeting, but to hematology laboratories worldwide. So the mission then was to develop a set of functional guidelines that would aid laboratories in reducing the number of hematology result reviews and reduce the number of subsequent procedures they are required to perform without losing any useful clinical data. How was this done? We met, and a group of people, as I said, were people who had used decision rules for some time. So there were really people who were proficient in the use of decision rules, and people from a wide variety of laboratories and hospitals throughout the world. And as you look through the list of participants, you'll see there are many from the US, there are several from Canada, there are several from Europe, and there are a couple from Asia. So this was really a worldwide meeting, an international hematology consensus group. So we met for 2 days in the hot desert sun in Palm Desert. 20 laboratory hematologists put our heads together. We each brought with us our rules. We consumed about 200 sodas, teas, and coffee during that period. And we brought with us 2,000 lab rules, but that's just to keep it in twos. There were actually about a total of 950 rules because we each brought with us the rules that we used in our own labs, and we discussed them, and we went through it in great detail. And eventually we came up as a consensus with 83 rules we could test in our labs to test the efficacy of these 83 rules. So we developed a protocol. And the protocol was for each lab, the goal was to find 1,000 patient specimens from the daily workload over several days, and approximately 200 of these specimens should be specimens which had had previous results, so we could test the delta rules. We recorded all the analyzer results, including flags, vote-outs, etc. We reviewed smears from all patients, even though we might not normally do it. As part of the study, we reviewed all smears to determine as a benchmark, as a standard, what the abnormalities were in each of those patient specimens. And we compared, for each lab, we compared their own rules which they had been using with a consensus rule, so each of the participating labs could get a sense of how their rules compared to at least the common opinion of everyone. We then compared the efficacy of the individual consensus rules. We then analyzed the data, and we came up with a set of rules. And so, just a little more detail about it. We felt that this was reasonably comprehensive and reasonably representative of what we find in laboratories. We used analyzers from Bayer, Abbott, Beckman, and Sysmex. So four of the major hematology analyzer manufacturers had their analyzers represented in the study. We also had to determine what was a positive smear finding. I won't go into this in great detail because I know many of you are not specifically interested in hematology, but we decided, because we had to determine what was a significant positive smear finding. As we know, many times in the hematology lab, you'll have somebody looking at a smear and say, slight anisocytosis, slight microcytosis, slight something else. Because then if somebody, a supervisor or the lab director, looks at the smear and says, my God, this is severely microcytic. Didn't you see the microcytosis? Well, I did, but I didn't think it was quite so bad, so that's why I put slight. So we had to determine what was really significant. So for most of these morphology findings, we took a 2+, or what might be reported as a moderate or greater, as being significant. So that was for smear findings. And then for abnormal cell types, we actually took, mainly as a guideline, an NCCLS document for the standard reference differential H20, and we looked at one blast or more as being significant, and a couple of other abnormal cells as well. So those are the criteria we developed for a positive smear. We then compared what we had found with the rules with a positive smear finding. And so the rules were actually separated into 5 main categories: WBC parameters, platelets, red cell hemoglobin, differential parameters, absolute count differential parameters, not percentages, suspect codes and flags, a separate rule for neonates. We looked at both first-time findings as well as subsequent samples to give delta checks. And with all of the data analysis of what came out of those labs, we came up with 41 consensus rules. These are the so-called ISLH consensus rules, which are published on the website, and I'll go into that in a moment. And some of these consensus rules have significance for us here. Most of them have no significance when they're beyond what we would really be interested in, so I won't go into them. But just to look at a couple of the things. A white cell count of greater than 4 and less than 11 is usually regarded as within the normal range. So if there were no flags, it wouldn't require smear review. However, if there was any white cell flag from the analyzer was indicating something, whether it was a false positive or not. So the rule is review a smear, review a slide, because the analyzer has flagged. However, let's look at the next one. Even with a white cell count way out in the abnormal range, above 11, which is the upper limit of normal, and less than 50 with no white cell flags, the data and the analysis of the data showed that this could be verified without smear review. We did not find unsuspected findings in those patients. So the rules then were able, we could come up with this. Compare this with what I'd mentioned before, where at Sinai we had said, if everything is normal, we won't have to review the smear, we can order verify. And of course, if there is no further action on the count, what that implies, if there's no further action on the sample, that implies that those results can be auto-verified. So unless there's a smear review or some other test, it means it's auto-verified. So those for white cell count, there were rules for the differential count, and as you see, the second one, if you glance at that, was if the neutrophil count is less than 1, but it passes the delta check. In other words, we did have, within the last 72 hours, an abnormal count, which was less than 1, and there's no blast flag, just verify. In other words, send out. You do not need to review a smear. For a monocyte count, which is greater than 1.5, if it's the first time or the delta test has failed, one needs to do a smear. And so going through line by line, there are these rules which have been developed, and there are 41 rules in all, some for platelets, some for red cell counts. For example, if the MCV is less than 75, which would be microcytosis, but we had one before, in other words, it passes the delta verify. However, if there wasn't a delta, then we would review the smear. And with all of this, what data did we have? We actually, out of the 20 participating labs who participated in the meeting, We actually had 15 labs who did the tests within their own labs and who actually participated. So we have 13,298 samples, certainly far more than could be collected by one lab, representative of labs throughout the world. And as you see here, the false negatives were 2.9% of the total. A fairly low, certainly a very low percentage. False positives were 18.6%. And for most of the individual labs, these were actually lower false positive rates and lower false negative rates than those labs were obtaining themselves. So this was the data analysis with the truth table for all the labs. Now, false negatives are a problem. We don't want to harm the patient. So here is an analysis of the false negatives. And as you can see, most of them were because a metamyelocyte or two was seen on the smear but had not been flagged by the analyzer, and so it wasn't picked up. There were some platelet clumps, there were nucleated reds, et cetera, et cetera. And there were really very few false negative flags that had any significance. Even for the blasts, there were just a few samples where there were one or two blasts which were seen on the smear which had not been detected before. So the false negative rate was really very low, and we were comfortable with what we'd achieved there. So we decided that we would publish this on the ISLH website. They are freely available to anybody in any lab who wishes to use them, to any vendor, manufacturer, any LIS vendor, middleware vendor, analyzer vendor who wishes to use them. They're made freely available. The idea is that we encourage people in hematology laboratories to try out the rules and then give feedback so that we can improve the rules. So they're on the ISLH website, and the listing of the rules, the table is there on the website as well. I do want to acknowledge the four people who were actually very much involved with the analysis and the publication, who did a lot of work, the steering group, Stephanie McFadden, Pat Barnes, Sam Mation, and I had a fair amount to do with it myself. And so the acknowledgements, again, are on the website. But more important than the acknowledgement is contact information. So if you do want to contact any member of the steering committee to discuss anything about the rules, contact information is their email, telephone, and snail mail address as well. And we also had a journal publication. It was accepted by peer review for publication in the Journal of Lab Hematology in the first issue of last year, so it's also available in print form. Okay, now the next question is how to implement the consensus rules. Or as we study one of the road signs near where I live, one asks the question, how do you get there from here? Again, some reality bites. We have fewer medical technologists, fewer medical technology schools. The average age of a medical technologist now is 50. They are more generalists than specialists. Instruments, as we know, are much more automated than any other time, and we expect techs to look after many more tests than at any previous time. Let's look at a typical day in the life of a lab tech. Reporting 200 to 400 patient profiles per shift while the phones are ringing, the boss wants more, now the residents walk in to look at a smear. And with all of the high-tech equipment in most labs today, what are the technologists spending most of their time on? And as we saw before, and as you saw from the Sinai data itself, most of the time, or at least 37% of the time, which is equivalent to operational time, people are reviewing results and reviewing smears. And in reviewing them, they have to look at normal ranges, critical values have to be reported, there are the delta check, the relationship of the parameters. Some physicians want some special handling, and this is what techs are spending their time on. Now, with all of this, how does everyone know the rules? We all have procedure manuals. CAP inspects us and says, let's look at the procedure manual. Everything is there. That's our reference, the procedure manuals. So everybody refers to the procedure manuals to know the rules. The reality check is they posted sheets on instruments, they're on cabinets, countertops, inside the lab coats, in memory. My memory is different to yours. I work in lab A during the day. I work in lab B during the night. Rules are different from lab A to lab B. So we kind of have some confusion as to which rules to use. And with automated hematology analyzers, we're being supplied with better and faster hematology analyzers almost day by day. And we hear this, the salespeople say, my hematology analyzer is faster than his hematology analyzer. But does it really matter that the hematology analyzer can do over 100 samples per hour if your brain can only go 35? So what's the answer? The answer, obviously, as we've seen, is automation of the review process. And this maximizes the instrument capabilities while minimizing patient risk. It reduces technologist interventions. We see all the good things that automation of the review process will do, specifically now in the context of what I said previously, which is where is the next big improvement we can make in our labs? The software solutions can be an LIS or middleware in LIS. We've had a lot of discussion today about middleware, and I'm not going to repeat everything you've heard, but a lot of it is exactly what you've heard before. We know. We've heard extensive definitions, and Robert Michaud gave us some very interesting information. The software between the analyzer and the LIS. The most important thing about the middleware is that it contains the lab rules. It will hold back samples for review. It will pass to the LIS, usually for reporting, those samples which do not need review and can be reported. And the important thing for the hematology lab is that the middleware will display all the results and store all the results, not only in numeric form, but the scatter plots, the cytograms, the histograms. And this is important. In addition, all of these are viewable by the technologist who now has to make the decision as to whether to pass the results or do something else. And they're viewable at different workstations throughout the lab, including the manager's office or the hematopathologist's office. And specimen results are stored with everything related to the specimen. Some people ask, well, why do you need to store all that data? Just as one small example, in New York State, New York State has a regulation that every result, every differential count result, has to have a smear. And that smear has to be retained by the lab for 2 years. So that's what's in the books. However, there is a waiver. If you're using an analyzer which does not produce a smear, and you have not produced a smear because by your criteria you didn't think a smear was necessary, but you've reported a differential using the automated analyzer, if you keep a printout of the cell patterns, of the differential cell count pattern, that's okay. So in our lab, we're contributing to deforestation of the environment, because what we do is we print out all these sheets of paper, we put them in boxes, they go off-site if necessary. We have no way really of looking for them if we have to. They're stored in boxes, but they are there for regulatory purposes just in case. Now, with middleware, we can store all of that, we can review it, we can build libraries so we can get a lot of useful information. So the advantages are multifold, and the critical point is that in middleware, as we have been told, creation of the rules is easier, the rules can be more complex, we can review complete data from multiple analyzers at one workstation. And just a few examples. I'm certainly not promoting any product whatsoever, but just a few examples which will show all the details, the numeric results, the scatter plots. It also shows information for the technologist, the next step in what is the next step, what is an instruction, what to do next. Previous results are available. And so all this information is available at the technologist's workstation at the time that they are determining whether more work needs to be done or whether the smear needs to be reviewed. And if one is using rules such as the consensus group rules, a lot of the decisions are made even before it gets to this point. But the middleware then has those rules within it. So again, some examples in here, quality control, again from a middleware supplier. And so we can see that there is a lot of information here which is not available on most LIS systems. The tech instructions, because the middleware or the rules, the automated process, can tell the tech what to do. The tech instruction could be as simple as scan the slide. So the tech doesn't have to be asking somebody else, what do I need to do with this? The instructions can be more complex. Rule out a cold agglutinin or lipemia per lab standard operating procedure number 566. These rules display on the results screen so it's easily visible to the technologists, and it's useful to all staff because it's an aid to memory. Let's just look at a couple of the consensus rules as they can be applied in an automated fashion. Consensus rule number 9 states, if the hemoglobin is less than 7 grams per deciliter or more than 2 grams per deciliter above the upper reference range for age and sex, then do a slide review if it's the first time and verify sample integrity if it's indicated from the slide review that you should do so. In other words, was that hemoglobin, everything looks normal, was it just dilution through an intravenous solution or something of that sort? Another example, consensus rule number 35, if there is an atypical variant lymph flag from the analyzer, step is slide review. This is easily handled by what we call middle hemeware, in other words, middleware applied to hematology. It is handled by an LIS if the LIS can accept instrument comments and histograms, and it can display tech instructions. My own view is that, and I certainly don't want to get into any controversy versus LIS versus middle hemeware, it's just a question of how capable is the LIS and where should all of this be? Should it be in the analyzer? Should it be in the middleware? Should it be in the LIS? But nevertheless, with what we have done, particularly with the international consensus rules, to have this available in an automated fashion is very helpful and significant in our opinion. How it's done is something outside the scope of this discussion. Parameter combinations, consensus rule number 36. An atypical or variant lymph flag with previous confirmed result and a positive delta flag for WBC. Instruction to the tech, slide review. What do I do now? The tech is thinking, it's this, it's that, it's the other. Slide review, very simple. One can easily write this rule in middleware, but it's difficult to write such a complex rule in LIS systems. Last one, example number 4. Tailoring consensus rules to physicians. Perhaps Dr. Jones is different to all others, but he carries a lot of weight in the hospital. He's the president of the medical board, a very influential pediatrician, and he says, for all of my samples, I don't care what rules you have for anybody else. I want to know, and I want to have a smear reviewed, if that white count is over 20. And I don't care if for other doctors you're doing over 30. So this is a situation where you need a special rule for Dr. Jones, and again, that is more easily written in most middleware systems than in LIS. And so, in summary, the realized benefits of middleware are one is able to view multiple hematology analyzers from one workstation. So multiple analyzers. We have 4 on our line. If we could review it from one workstation, it helps enormously with no paper printouts. Easier creation of rules, standardized rules for review. It decreases the overall turnaround time. We get more work per technologist. We can increase the order validation rate. And most importantly, the technologists are able to spend more time focusing on abnormal samples where their manual skills and their cerebral skills in looking at smears are more important. So in conclusion, the hematology laboratory is a more complex operation than most laboratories. We have initiated standardization of decision rules, and I think that what is available through the ISLH website can be very valuable to everyone. By no means is there any implication that this is the final word on the subject. A group of people got together, shared their expertise, did a study which would be very difficult for any individual lab to do, and I think is more valuable because it was 15 labs in different parts of the world, pooled that knowledge, analyzed it, came up with the rules. So those are a set of rules to be made available to the lab, hematology community at large. Feedback is important. We really envisage that these rules will be refined in the light of experience, wider experience, and will be far more useful and productive going forward. And because the automation of the rules is available, it seems presently that middleware provides the preferred solution. So I hope I've been able to cover most of what would interest you, and I'd appreciate any feedback. Thank you very much. Thank you.